Y'all, it's Jey Uso from WWE.
And I'm Jimmy Uso.
Chumba Casino and WWE are hyped for the biggest event of the summer, SummerSlam.
I know, I can't wait.
There's nothing better to do while we're waiting
than playing Chumba Casino.
Sign up today and you could win a VIP experience
with Chumba Casino and WWE for SummerSlam.
So what are you waiting for?
Play Chumba Casino and enter for your chance to win. Let's Chumba.
Yeah. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs, and become a patron today to show your support and get instant access to our extensive archive of downloadable ad-free tales of terror. Thank you for listening. And enjoy the show.
Good evening. I'm storyteller Otis Gyre, and I ain't your grandfather. From where I'm from, we don't do bedtime stories. And if that's what you were expecting, you're in the wrong place. If it's terrifying tales you're after, well then, I've got just the thing. Get comfortable, settle in, turn off the lights, if you dare. Your night is about to get a whole lot darker. Who needs sleep anyway?
Good evening. You're listening to Scary Stories Told in the Dark. Welcome to Season 4, Episode 5. I'm your host, Otis Gyre. In tonight's episode, I'll be performing four stories for you about creepy cabins, waterborne beasts, parasitic pets, and foreshadowing fog. You're listening to the standard edition of tonight's program. If you'd like to show your support and enjoy an extended version of this and other episodes with twice the terror, visit simplyscarypodcast.com and click Patrons in the upper menu to sign up today. Thank you for your support. Now, it's time to get to take a walk together down the moonlit trail. So lock your doors, turn your lights down low, and settle in. The show's about to begin. Our first tale of terror this evening comes to us, courtesy of author J.D. Lucien, about the strange things that can happen in an isolated Louisiana bayou in the dead of night. Without further ado, I present to you A Cabin in the Swamp.
My brother and I bought the camp in Des Allemands for a song. It was an old trapper's cabin, set back down the bayou, well off the main lake, back in the swamp. It had no electricity, no water, no modern appliances. It needed some work. A while back, an old man who owned it couldn't manage the taxes and was run off. We only had to pay a small fee and what he owed, which really didn't amount to much. At the time, we thought it was a real steal. The paperwork was finished on a Wednesday, and my brother and I met in Lafayette to sign everything. We loaded the bateau on Friday afternoon after work and left the launch about supper time for the weekend. It was hot, Louisiana hot, and even as the sun dipped to touch the treetops, the heat was merciless. A lee turned the bateau north and opened her up. The wind in my face was cooking me thoroughly, and I could feel my skin crisping in the sunset. I looked back at my brother in the stern, his hand on the throttle of the old Evinrude as it purred and pushed us up the lake. He was our father's complexion, and was as dark and tanned as aged cypress. I'm more like pine, our mother's color, and he had been after me about sunscreen from the moment we'd left the truck. A heron leapt from its perch at the sound of the motor, and I dipped my fingers in the passing water. It was black as good coffee, but for the curls of pale foam, impenetrable to the eye. Gators, plentiful in the Alamo, and this evening was no exception as they cruised the lily pads and marsh grass for supper. A. Lee was keeping to the right-hand side, and every now and then the brown and green of the swamp was broken by the surprising white of an egret. I took a deep breath. The air was full of the odor of life and decay, of the living and the dead. Maybe half an hour later, we sighted the surveyor's tape that marked our path. He turned the bateau up into the bayou, barely slowing his hand, sure. Nearly instantly, the cypress and Spanish moss cut the sun, leaving us in the humid shade. A gator slipped into the water from its place on the muddy bank among the palmettos. It churned the grass, but by the time we were past, there was no sign of the water of its going. I turned back to my brother and smiled. He raised an excited hand, thumb up. We reached the cabin maybe an hour before full dark, and A. Lee slid the bateau against its weathered piling so it could tie us off. A rickety ladder allowed us to climb to the porch, built high to keep the inevitable tidal surge of the hurricanes from washing the house away. The Evinrude puttered and died in the chorus of tree frogs, and insects swept in to fill the absence. Spiders' webs were stretched from piling to piling, full of shrimp nets with writhing bugs. "Get your ass up there, Joseph," my brother was laughing. "We ain't got all day." I grabbed the spare rope. A particularly fat spider scurried away from my hand as I gripped the rung. I watched it disappear into a wide crack between two beams. "God damn, but you're slow." My brother was impatient at the best of times. I climbed to the porch, letting down a line to see A. Lee so that he could pass up our gear. It was all easy enough, except for the full cooler of ice and water, and my brother and I struggled mightily to get that up. A. Lee's head was just visible above the deck as I pulled the key from around my neck and unlocked the new padlock with which we had latched the door last week. "You're going to open the door or what?" he said. I could hear the excitement in his voice. "Quiet down, old man. Don't make me put you in your place. If you have a brother, you know how the banter goes." I watched him step up onto the deck and dust his hands on his pants. "Oh, I'd like to see that," he laughed, opening the lid of the cooler and tossing me an icy bottle of water. I pushed the door open and stepped into the sweltering heat of the cabin. It was dark and still and all the more uncomfortable for it. The cabin wasn't big, 20 by 20 or thereabout, but it had a largest table and a few serviceable wooden chairs, a bunk, and a wood-burning stove. It smelled musty. It smelled like it had been closed for a long time. It smelled like the family vault in Abbeville. I shook this thought off and took a long swallow of water. I could feel the cold coil itself through my guts. A few skeeters had already found their way through the open door and were buzzing round my head despite the lacquered coating of deep woods off. We need to get on that screen pronto. A. Lee nodded and swallowed. Damn, but it's hot, he yelled from the porch. I returned to the deck and grabbed my work belt. He unrolled the screen as I opened the windows and called out the numbers on my tape measure. A. Lee cut the screen to size and held it while I hammered a few staples in to fasten it flush with the wood. My eyes stung from sweat, and I rubbed my wet forearm across my face in a dubious effort to dry them. I turned to drop my belt on the table just as a filthy white cat walked through the door. Its hair was matted in clumps, dirty with only God knew what. It eyed my brother and me, its lips curling back slightly to expose its teeth. A. Lee stomped his foot, feigning a leap. The cat hissed and stood its ground. I tried to edge around, putting myself opposite the cat and the door. I hoped to flush the cat out onto the porch, but it had other ideas and rushed past me into the cabin. "Where the hell did you go?" my brother asked. I turned again. The cabin, a single room, table, chairs, bunk, and stove, but no cat. There must be a hole somewhere, I said. Yeah, maybe behind the stove, my brother said, crossing the room to inspect it. With the windows open, there was enough light to see, but the shadows were deep enough to hide a cat. Flashlight? On the porch, I unzipped my pack and found my headlamp. I tossed it to A. Lee and watched as he searched behind the stove. I heard him shake the stovepipe, heard its firm contact with the wall. He shook his head. Nothing. He drew the beam of the headlamp over the bunk and corner in which it lay. The wall was good there, too. Screw it, then, he said. The cat's gone. Good enough, he replied. The sun was down by the time we had our stuff in the cabin. A. Lee lit the propane lantern and set it on the table. I used my pocket knife to cut the tops off nearly empty water bottles, scooped some ice from the cooler into a makeshift glasses, and poured a few fingers of Crown Royal into each. A. Lee smiled, took a sip, smiled again, and took my hand. Woo-hoo! We got ourselves a camp, brother! His eyes twinkled in the lamplight. We dusted off two of the chairs and set 'em side by side near the table. There's no sense putting the cap back on the bottle, at least not this early in the evening. We sliced cheese and dried sausage, sipped whiskey, and retold the misadventures of our youth. Outside, the frogs were singing their hearts out. Bottle was about half full when our conversation turned to the trapper. I wonder what happened to that old guy. A. Lee mused. I could see that he felt sorry for him, sorry in some sense that the old man had lost the camp the way he had. He was always a fan of underdogs. I don't know, I said. I'm sure he moved on. A. Lee freshened his drink. You know what was strange? He looked troubled. His eyes tightened in that way that he has when he's thinking. What? I asked. That cat wasn't wet. My brother paused and took another sip of whiskey. Out here on the bayou. It was my turn to sip and think. Maybe it lives in the cypress, jumps from tree to tree. Maybe, he said. You wishing on a caller? I asked, smiling past my cup. We both knew what that meant. Down here, the loup garou is the boogeyman that keeps kids up at night. Supposedly, it's a bit obsessive-compulsive and stops to count all the little holes before it can enter a house at night. The more superstitious have been known to hang a colander or cheese grater by the door for just this reason. Suddenly, Ailey laughed. "Ain't scared of nothing," he said, twisting his voice into his best imitation of a Marksville hillbilly we used to know. I joined him, jumping to my feet. "Nothing," I yelled. Just then, the hiss of a cat strangled our laughter. It was a long, sharp sound that carried through the walls of the cabin, and something in that tone of that angry wail was almost human. The swamp creatures felt it, too, and the frogs went silent. Neither of us said a thing for a few seconds. "The cat?" Ailey nodded. "Yeah, I think so." "Damn." "Damn's right," he said, setting his drink on the table. Beads of condensation rolled down the side of the plastic and under the table. "I wish we had a 22, I said. My brother nodded and mimed shooting. Pop, pop. A breeze rose and stirred the palmetto leaves into their characteristic growl. The air was thick with humidity, and Ailey's shirt sagged with damp. Mine was much the same. I ran the side of my plastic cup across my forehead, and the whiskied ice numbed my skin in a few seconds. God bless the man who invented the cooler. The frogs' voices rose in chorus again, supported by the low growl of the corrugated leaves. "Whiskey?" I asked. Ailey lifted his cup, and I sloshed in a few swallows. He took a sip and sighed. "Oh, we got ourselves a camp," he said. Another quarter of a bottle, a crown later, I threw a sleeping bag over the bunk. Ailey pulled a chair over to the bed and secured a skeeter net from one of the exposed roof beams. We'd want that, even with the windows screened, until we could do something about the door. We peeled our clothes off and stretched them across the backs of our chairs. "Damn, he's hot," I said. I took a handful of ice from the cooler and mopped my face with it, relishing the momentary cool. My brother grunted in affirmation. "Rethinking the generator?" "Now I am," I flopped onto the bunk bed next to him. "Now I am." My dreams were troubled as I baked and turned like a rotisserie chicken. By morning, I was well done. I heard Ailey rise at dawn as I drowsed in half-sleep. "Screw you," he laughed, shoving the bunk with his foot and startling me awake.
"What?"
"You know what, asshole." "No, really," I said, wiping my eyes and yawning. I sat up. "The table," he said. "What about it?" His mouth twisted for a second and his eyes narrowed. "Come see," he said. I rolled out the bunk, found my feet, and joined him. In the center of the table, cut into the boards in rough letters, with two words, "Get out." My pocket knife was open, stuck point first, just like above the T. "You telling me you didn't do this?" my brother said, looking me in the eye. I could tell by his tone that he wasn't kidding around. I shook my head. "No." Ailey nodded and pulled my knife from the wood, folded it closed, and handed it to me. "Don't leave it out again," he said. I was spooked. My brother was spooked. Hell, who wouldn't have been? Folks down here are more trucked with the weird. Simple fact. From voodoo to hoodoo, from loup-garou to treacher, we immersed in the strange. Some tread water, some dip their feet in, hell, a few dive deep. But it's like the heat of Soto I-10. Ain't no way getting away from it. Maybe that's why we, spooked or not, wordlessly gathered out rods and tackle, our off and sunscreen, fished a few nearly frozen Starbucks cans espressos out of the cooler, and started to bateau into the path of swamp that never really became ours that Wednesday when Ailey and I signed our names in bold blue ink at the realtor's office in Lafayette. The cypress knees rose from the black water like the lower teeth of some great monster. Here and there, small lagoons of lily and still black water broke the swamp. Ailey cut the avenue at the most promising and sent a sparkling white rooster tail in a long, slow arc to land next to Stump with a soft plop. Within seconds, he had a strike, and seconds later, a fat sacoulet was wriggling at the bottom of the bateau. The sun sent fingers through the cypress that fell underwater, the lilies and us. A bright blue dragonfly, iridescent in the sun, settled on the bow next to me, still as stone. I watched it for a few seconds between casts. The fish were biting, and I made a stringer from a length of bank line and a few fresh twigs cut from a low branch. It was soon heavy with our struggling dinner. I was feeling better, and so was Ailey. "Oh, we got a mess of fish," I said. Ailey smiled. "You want to clean them here or back at the camp?" Fresh fish cuts in the water wouldn't hurt the fishing any, so I decided to do it now. Out came the pocket knives and out went the scales. Bellies were split, entrails pulled, and Ailey, always meticulous, scraped the back of their cavities to remove any sign of bitter innards. As we worked, we rinsed our catch into swamp water, and every so often a flash of silver white told me that a cannibal was feasting just below the surface. My brother fired up the motor, spun us neatly around, and brought us back to the camp. I took a stringer of fish and climbed a ladder. My head was just even with the planks of the deck when I saw it. The white cat stood just by the door in the dark of the cabin. We'd forgotten to close and lock the door. It hissed a warning to me, long, pale teeth bared to the gums. "Shoo!" I yelled. "Scat!" The cat hissed again and turned slowly, watching me with its green eyes as it slunk farther into the cabin. I dropped the fish on the deck and pulled myself up. "The cat?" Ailey asked. "Yeah. Screw him." I could tell the spook was back on him. In truth, the hairs on my neck were straight and stiff. "I don't know, Ailey," I began. "Maybe we should just go." "Screw that," he said. "This is our camp." The cat hissed from somewhere in the cabin. "Ours!" Ailey called from the ladder. I dug through our gear for a skillet and a bag of fish fry. From the porch, I watched my brother unscrew the lantern from the propane tank and replace it with a small camp stove. "Joseph, you going to get help or what?" he asked. His mind was set and, like an anchor, kept me falling back further into the spook. It took an effort, but I made my legs move and managed to cross the threshold. I was picking the last bits of flesh from the bones when Ailey poured the whiskey. I nibbled the tail, fried hard and crisp, and took a long, slow slip of cold crown. "Ailey," I said. "Yeah?" "We got to do something." "We ain't got to do nothing but have a good time," he said. He touched his plastic to mine, as he expected, the fine ring of crystal. "Drink up, and I'll pour another." "Maybe we should talk to Richard," I said, saying his name like we do. Richard. He knows about things like this. Nobody knows about things like this. Hell, this ain't even a thing. Just some damn cat in an old cabin. Neither of us mentioned the table. It wouldn't bear mentioning, if you know what I mean. I noticed, clearly, for the first time, that my brother had covered the carved words with a cutting board. Ailee sensed my fear. It's just a cat in a cabin, Joseph. Drink up. I did, emptying my cup in slow swallows. Ailee poured more whiskey over the ice. We may have to make a run for Mokran, he said, forcing a laugh. Don't want to run dry. He sloshed the last few fingers in the bottle for emphasis, then caught my eye. Our camp, he said. Ours. The hair on my arms prickled, and despite the heat, shivered. Behind my brother, a dark shadow hung suspended from a ceiling beam. A man on a rope, his feet swinging inches from the floor. What? Ailee asked. What's up? I could feel the blood leave my face and pointed. Ailee turned and the shadow was gone. But it hadn't been my imagination. I was sure of it. The rope. I knew it was a rope. A hanged man. The trapper. Ailee, I said, my words a whisper. Screw that, he said, taking another long sip of whiskey, and screw you. He wasn't talking to me. My brother's a stubborn man, and he will have his way, come hell or high water. We did indeed make a run for Mokran, down the bayou again, Spanish moss dancing in the wind. Clouds were building and the sky was a blue-gray tinged with black and purple. The lake was already rough and the wind was teasing the waves into small crests. The storm's coming, I said as we pushed off the pier. My brother nodded. We needed to get up the lake in a hurry. Risk swamping. And he opened the throttle, and the Evinrude roared into action. This time I sat in the stern near him to avoid most of the spray, and we took turns sipping from the bottle, swallowing whiskey like it was medicine, which I suppose in a way it was. It was grim revelry, and our mood was as dark as the sky. Our camp, Ailee had said. Ours. Didn't feel like that, though. Blue ink and Landry's realty or not. By the time we reached the shelter of the bayou, the lake was nigh impassable for a small boat. But here, the close trees and swamp sheltered the water, and though the cypress were cutting a rug above us, the bayou's black water was as still as a grave. Ailee raced the storm and the swamp whipped past. There was an excitement to it, an obvious, fearful energy crackling before the storm. Lightning pealed overhead and the sky opened up, spilling rain in great drenching sheets. The cabin came into view as we rounded a last bend, and my brother waited to release the throttle. Sliding between pilings and under the camp, I batted webs away with that terrible feeling you get when you just know a spider's on you when the silk's in your face. Ailee was having none of it and seized the piling, bringing the bateau to a stop. I felt stupid and childish. I stopped fighting the spiders and tied us off. We'd bought some more ice for the cooler at Lucky's, and Ailee threw the bags over his shoulder and climbed the ladder without a word. I grabbed a bottle and followed him up. We both paused after I unlocked the door, rain streaming down our faces, shirts plastered to our skin with water. My brother broke our paralysis, giving the old wood a push with his foot. I looked, and I'm sure he did too, though he made an effort at nonchalance. The cabin was as we had left it. I could breathe. In we went, the wind now howling in the trees. The rain beat the roof in a steady drumming, revealing copious leaks. A. Lee had the lantern going shortly. The cloud-dimmed sky wasn't giving much light. I cracked the ice on the floor a few times to break it up, tore the bags open and spilled it loudly into the cooler. My brother scooped our plastic cups full and poured a hefty measure of Crown into each of them. He pulled up a chair and stirred his drink with one of his meaty fingers. The storm was raging across the swamp. "Do you remember Erlene's doll?" he asked, spinning the ice. "Oh, yeah," I said. Our Aunt Erlene had an old doll with a porcelain face that she kept in a chair in the bedroom. Its painted features were weathered and worn, his glass eyes terrible and deep. It had a pull string on the back, but we never dared to discover what it might say. We used to dare each other to pull it, but neither of us ever had the nerve. "Just like that," he said, taking a sip. "Just like that." "What do you mean?" "The cabin. It's spooky, but it ain't gonna hurt us none." I considered that as I swallowed a mouthful of Crown. We never pulled that string, but here we were, pulling on something that felt far worse. "I suppose," I said. "But A. Lee's my older brother, even as a grown man, if he said so. I had faith, old school, kneeling on pine plank faith. This is our camp," he said, tapping the table for emphasis, "and I aim to enjoy it. Our camp." I needed to piss something fierce, which is not a good sign when whiskey is being your only beverage. I made my way to the half-open door, and wet as I already was, stepped onto the deck to pee off the edge. Our camp. Lightning flashed brightly against the dark sky, and the thunder hurt my ears and sent my head pounding. I turned to see A. Lee. That lightning had been close. What I saw froze my mouth, and it was as if my heart struggled against a firm grip, one crippled, sideways, thumping beat at a time. There was a man behind him, on the other side of the table, an old man in raggedy clothes. He had long white hair, but what struck me most was the coiled noose around his neck and the dangling rope lost beneath the shadows of the table. The trapper. His camp. I tried to call out, but my mouth opened and no sound slipped out. "Get out!" roared the old man, his voice like a storm wind. The door slammed shut loud as the thunderclap had been. A. Lee was inside his camp. I felt a cold hand on my neck, and I was falling 15 feet into the bayou. I hit flat and hard, felt the slap of the warm water, felt the embrace of its black arms sinking, sinking. I tried to kick, but something had me, something cold as the ice in our cooler. It was pulling me down and down, deeper into the muddy water. I was going to die right there, right then. But then I thought of A. Lee, in the cabin, his cabin, behind that closed door. I couldn't leave him, not like that, not in his cabin. I kicked viciously and worked my arms like mad. Whatever it was, let me go, and I rocketed to the surface, my head breaking water in the rain. A few strokes had me to the ladder, and I pulled myself onto the lowest rung and climbed for all I was worth. I'm not a small man, and I hit the door like a hurricane. It held. I backed up and hit it again. It resisted for an instant, then swung open, spilling me onto the floor. Lightning flashed. The propane lamp was dead. Ailee was on the floor. I grabbed my brother by his leg and heaved him across the floor to the deck. In the dim stormlight, Cyprus whipping in the wind, I looked down at my brother's open eyes and dead pale face.
He can't be dead.
He can't be dead.
He can't be dead. He can't be dead.
Lee! I yelled over the storm.
Lee!
I slapped him hard. He choked and sputtered and drew a large, halting breath.
Joseph?
He asked.
Yeah, it's Joseph.
I cradled his head in my arms.
I got you, brother.
He had to close his eyes from the rain.
Joseph!
I slung Ailee across my shoulder and tried to stand. My legs burnt with the effort, and my bad knee gave a sickening pop. But I got to my feet and staggered to the ladder. I'm not sure how I managed to get us both down, but I did. I led my brother into the bateau as gently as I could, untied us, and got the Evinrude going. It sputtered to life, and I gave it gas. I bounced the bow off a piling, got us cleared, and launched us out into the rain. I swung the tiller hard and had the motor roaring, thunder pealing into the bayou toward the lake. I risked one look back. I wish I hadn't. There in the doorway was the trapper, his rope whipping in the storm like a lash. His mouth was moving, though I couldn't hear him over the engine. I knew what he said.
Get out!
We spent a long, wet night in the swamp. I ran us aground under the thickest set stand of cypress I could find. But I knew we couldn't risk the lake in this weather. The rain and the wind beat the swamp all night. But at least it kept the worst of the skeeters at bay. Ailee soon regained his senses, roused almost as if from sleep, and sat up in the bateau.
Joseph?
Yelly, it's all right, we good. That seemed to satisfy him. We sat there in the dark, huddled in the bateau till first light. Needless to say, we didn't go back to the camp. And when it was light enough to see, I started up the Evinrude and took us to the launch. It was a long, silent drive home. We never been back to the camp, his camp. I don't expect we will. You can believe whatever you want, that I was drunk and fell from the porch, that my imagination conjured the trapper, that a gust of wind shut the door and that lightning struck a bit too close to Ailee that night. But I know what I believe. I know what's true. On paper, we still own that cabin. By law, it's ours. But it's not. It will never be. It's his. And it will be till the whole thing slips beneath that thick black water and is washed away in a storm. Maybe even after that. I hope you enjoyed The Cabin in the Swamp by J.D. Lucien, as performed by yours truly. Up next, I've got a second story for you. This one from an author who prefers to remain anonymous. In it, a gentleman with a primal fear of water tells us why he's been afraid of it for as long as he can remember, and why that will never change. Without further ado, I present to you Thalassophobia. I hate the water. Always have, always will. Oh, sure. I've swum in pools and jumped off diving boards like any other person. But I've never once allowed my feet to leave the ground at a lake or beach. Something about not having solid ground to stand on freaks me out. And the inky blackness surrounding you could be hiding anything. The silt swirling, shrouding this foreign environment in a sickly green-gray cloak. You're left defenseless, weak, out of your league, while everything in there with you has evolved to thrive. That tug you feel on your ankle could simply be the grasping tendrils of seaweed. But you panic at the thought of it being something more malicious. Your fight or flight response kicks in. Flight is your only option at this point. You're outmatched. It has you, and your only hope is to make a break for the surface. Desperately, you kick and claw at the water, hoping against hope that whatever's down there can't catch up. Slowly, you paddle up to the surface, but it's not enough. Humans were never meant to swim quickly. You feel those ghastly green ropes trying to tie you down like anchors, tightening, wrenching down on your heel. You look down in a vain attempt to free yourself, only to discover that it had been all in your head. That seaweed monster you envisioned was really just some aquatic weeds that had become tangled around you as you swam. I can't properly explain thalassophobia better than that. It's a primal, visceral fear, and for good reason. Our ancestors knew that in the water, they couldn't fight back against an attacker or even run away. And thus, they grew to fear that which they did not understand. Though as technology advanced, we enabled ourselves to indulge our curiosity and explore this forbidden land. However, many of us still retain that terror which our ancestors felt, and this is what led me in a direction I would ultimately regret following. My name's Dr. Francis Thurston. It's currently 12:05 p.m. on this 12th of April, 1923. I'm with patient 233-012, and this will be session number 3. The typewriter stamped each letter in harsh black ink with a sickening clack. Ever since opening this accursed mental health facility, I've had to play the sonographer in every single session I've done, and the incessant mechanical clicks of this damn machine are driving me mad. I had opened this facility in the hopes of shedding new light on mental illness. My colleagues believe these people are unfit to be treated as humans, seeing them as defective. What a load of crap-trap. These are human beings with thoughts and emotions, not some product of mishap on an assembly line. All right, so, ma'am, can you tell me about these dreams you've been having as of late? Her long black hair crinkled and parted as she lifted her head to speak. I see visions, Mr. Thurston. A city, just like out your window, but in the wrong spot. She gestured behind me at a glass pane that was the room's only source of natural light. All right, sir, that's interesting. Can you tell me why it's in the wrong spot? No, I can't, sir. All I know is that it was underwater. There was green light everywhere, and black things swimming down below me. It all looked so real, like I was looking at pictures. Odd, I thought. Some other patients told me similar things in their sessions as well. Sarah, could you tell me if you remember hearing anything? She looked around the room as she thought. No, sir. No voices, at least. I did hear this loud rumbling noise, but the sound, kind of like when a boulder falls down a slope, but that's all. Okay, good.
The typewriter had begun to get on my nerves once more. And what about when you're awake? Do you see anything then?
Oh, Lord, no, sir, nothing like that.
The most I'll hear or see is the people on the sidewalk, strolling by my window. I dismiss her and have a nurse escort her back to her room. Going over the notes on all my patients that had reported similar dreams, they all seemed completely unrelated. Sarah Stevens, a 31-year-old married mother of one. Jack Walters, a 37-year-old detective from across town, with no living kin to speak of, and Tom Sutton, a deranged man of 34, who, despite my reservations, my staff had to put in a straitjacket because he would fly into wild fits, yelling and screaming about eyes watching him and that he will awaken. The question of what length my patience would haunt me for over a month until the state would hand over a guilty defendant, whose attorney had tried for the insanity plea. The call came at 8:30. Storm clouds had blown in from the coast, and the chief of police wanted to get the defendant assessed as quickly as possible. As the stars were slowly blotted out of existence, the transport vehicle backed up, and two armed guards stepped out from either side. Doors flung open as the man was wheeled in. Leather belts adorned every limb, and a muzzle was strapped to the lower half of his face. Most striking were his eyes. As I held the door open for the guards, he turned to look as he passed. His pupils were shrunk, or maybe his eyes were open as wide as possible, but in them I saw a look of hollow fear, as though the being in front of me was simply a husk, scared for every waking moment of his life. I'm so sorry, Francis. The judge ordered an immediate examination of his mental state, and you were the only psychiatrist I knew who wouldn't have shot me dead as soon as I called. No, no, it's fine, Frank. I just wish you had given me more warning about it. So, what's all this about, anyhow? Well... He paused to remove his cap as he looked down at the floor. Even after becoming chief of police, Frank was a bit squeamish when it came time to reveal the more bloody details of his cases. His name is Harrison Brown. He's 32 years old, has had three children and a wife. According to his neighbors, he went on a trip to some town they'd never heard of. They said he was different once he returned. Listless, almost as if he had forgotten his personality back at that town. A few weeks later, those same neighbors complained about a smell coming from the house. When my officers got there, they found the bodies of his children and wife strewn around his living room. And upstairs... He paused to take a deep breath. Upstairs... My officers found him in what used to be the room of his youngest daughter. Symbols had been written on every exposed surface in what we think was his family's blood mixed with his own. He was curled up in a ball, staring at the corner of the room, muttering to himself. One of my men got close enough to hear what he was saying. And? Well... He ended up shooting himself a few days later. We never got to find out what he heard. As for the other officer, he's shell-shocked and has been throwing up at the sight of blood. We had to let him go for obvious reasons. All right. Well, I suppose I should get to work. If you'd be so kind. Oh, yes, absolutely. I'll send you a bottle of bourbon when this is over. Just to make sure not to let the state hear about it. I smiled as I showed him out. Frank had been a very close friend ever since high school, and when prohibition became law, we developed the habit of misplacing evidence on occasion, after a big case, or sometimes just because we felt like it. Returning to the room where I was storing Mr. Brown, I heard him shrieking. Most of it was garbled, but I could make out the words, "Water! Him! Scared! See!" As I wheeled him to my office, I noticed that he would go silent whenever lightning flashed, as if in anticipation. It's 8:27 p.m. My thoughts were elsewhere as I typed. For once, I failed to notice the sound of the typewriter.
"Hey, Doc. What you doing?"
His voice was hoarse as he croaked out each word. "Recording the time, date, and your name for the records. Now, can you tell me why you murdered your wife, Mr. Brown?"
"I did them a kindness, Doc. He saw me. He saw them. I shot them each in the head. Over in an instant, he was merciful, compared to what his followers would have done."
"And who is this he? And who are his followers?" His eyes squinted as the muscles in his cheeks tightened to form a grin. His pupils dilated, and for the first time, I saw just how dead behind the eyes he really was.
"He, the great dreamer. He who tends to the great old ones. He who would bring about the end of man. His followers be everywhere. They see all. They hear all. Nowhere is safe from them, not even the seas."
The mention of seas caught my attention. I had to ask. I felt an all-consuming curiosity to know, as if I was being pointed to it by an invisible stranger. "Mr. Brown, you don't happen to have dreams of a sunken city underwater, do you? Black figures moving below as green lights shine?" The grin he once held had widened. In all this time, he hadn't blinked even once, and his eyes had grown bloodshot.
"I'll cut you a deal, Doc. You let me out of this jacket for a few hours, and I'll tell y'all."
Against my better judgment, I unbuckled the restraints on his jacket. Before he was free, I locked the door and showed him the pistol I keep in my desk as a warning against attacking me. As I loosened the last strap, I felt his arms relax. He took a long, deep breath, savoring his newfound freedom, rotating his arms, jogging in place. He seemed like a perfectly normal man, except for his eyes. "So, what else do you know, Mr. Brown?" Mr. Brown would go on to explain about a town off the East Coast that he visited, all the way up to when he arrived on my doorstep in maximum security restraints. He seemed perfectly sane, except for the talk of some god and his cult. I allowed him to remain without his restraints for the remainder of his stay. I locked his room for the night and went to bed with little success. Regardless of the validity of his claims, Mr. Brown had still managed to get to me. That night, once I had managed to drift off, I experienced a very similar dream to what my patients had experienced. Maybe I was just letting everything get under my skin. A bottle of bourbon would be more welcome than I could have imagined. I awoke to the wail of a nurse. Bolting upright, I could hear her running down the halls in a panic. Tossing on something just so I was dressed, I ran to her. She had fallen against the wall and was wide-eyed and shivering. I asked what happened, and all she did was point a quivering finger to Mr. Brown's room. The door was cracked open, but there wasn't enough light from the window in his room to eliminate anything from where the nurse and I were. I stood up, turned toward the door, and took a step forward. The door handle was cold, the result of air conditioning chilling the metal without anything nearby to warm it. As the door opened, I could make out the bed that came in every room. The sheets were gone. More light was allowed in as the doorway opened, and I could see the back of a chair lying on the ground. More light rushed in and shone in the rest of the room. A sickening sound of fibers rubbing against each other while under tension. The groaning of the water pipe sounded overhead clear as day. I'd seen enough. I turned to close the door as something stopped me dead. Scrawled on the door, in his own blood, Mr. Brown had written, "She will lead the way." And below that was written what looked like to be a jumble of words. Cthulhu. Once the body had been taken down, Frank showed up with a bottle, he promised.
Damn, Francis. What the hell happened?
God only knows. I took a long swig in a vain attempt to forget what I'd seen. She will lead the way. What in God's name did that mean? It was only until I began to look into the pasts of some of my patients that I got my answer. All who had reported those same dreams had also, at one point or another, spent a significant amount of time in the town that Mr. Brown had visited, had been there most recently. Questioning her revealed the key to those strange mass dreams, as I was given directions to the unnamed town. A bus route ran there, as well as a few old railroads. A few spare clothes along with some money and I was off. The station where the bus ran to and from was just outside the city's outer limits. Gas lamps lit the road as moths fluttered about. The man at the ticket counter seemed nice, if a bit odd, when I mentioned my destination while ordering. The bus came, and I boarded. There was nothing remarkable about the whole trip. The bus driver was a portly man who wore a cap and old tattered clothes, but was otherwise fairly standard and normal. As we arrived at the town, it seemed as though it had been isolated from the rest of the world. Buildings resembling those from America's colonial days stood, though the paint and wood clearly weren't original to the structure, as they hadn't warped or faded. The roads were still cobblestone. However, they had gas lamps, which means that this town had contact with the outside world, though not for some time. People wandered about the streets, seemingly normal. There was nothing other than the lack of technology to suggest this town was anything but average. As I exited the bus, I was hit by just how salty and thick the air was. It was like trying to breathe in molasses with all the humidity. I'd need a place to stay, so I wandered the town, looking at the many houses that were, in reality, very pleasant to look upon. Eventually, I was approached by one of the townsfolk, a little girl in a bright yellow dress. She pointed me toward an inn with earnest zeal and skipped off. What is this town hiding that would drive people mad? Was all I could think of as the sun slowly set through the window in my small hotel room. The innkeeper was very pleasant, just like that girl. And so the story continued on and on for 2 more days, as people gave me confused looks when I poked and prodded about my patients, or the dreams, or the cult of him, as I had begun to think of it as. Maybe this was just a huge coincidence? Disheartened, I returned to my room for what would be the final night of my stay. Climbing into bed proved difficult, as did falling asleep. However, sleep did eventually come for me. A few hours later, I couldn't tell how many, I managed to force myself awake. A nightmare had taken me, and I woke to the feeling of clammy palms and soaked clothes. Before I had time to properly comprehend what was going on, I heard a noise of what seemed to be an animal outside. I was on the second floor, so it was probably safe to look out my window. On the street below, I saw nothing out of the ordinary. Street lamp, moths, and a cat. The alleyway across the street was pitch black, as the cat began to walk through it. It stopped suddenly, back arched as it hissed, poised to attack something hidden in the shadows. Without warning, a hand reached out at the cat, grabbing it before it had a chance to run. The hand appeared webbed, with sickly green and blue scales and fins. That's the best I can explain it. Immediately, I rushed out of that hotel, leaving behind all of my belongings. It was dark, but by the time I made it to the alley, whatever was hiding had gone. My best guess is that if what I saw was true, then whatever it was probably needed water to survive. With no time to waste, I ran till my lungs burned all the way to the docks. Stealing a boat that was left tied to a post, I rowed out, not knowing which direction to go or even how far. Eventually, when the strength of my arms had failed, I was left alone in the dark, the town far behind me, only visible by the dim lamps that lined the streets. Suddenly, I heard the subtle sound of something soft brushing along the underside of the boat. Some fish are probably curious, I thought, as I lay back to rest. Then, suddenly, as it had started, it stopped, and I was left in an oppressive, all-encompassing silence. Soon it became obvious, however, that my mysterious visitor hadn't quite left yet. Splashing to my left, or maybe it was to my right, something could be heard, and it was getting closer. As it approached my side, I became noticeably more anxious. What was coming for me? What was its intention? My mind was racing as the splashing disappeared, seeming to go under my boat. Again, I was gripped by silence. With a heavy thud, something hit the side of my boat, hard enough to capsize it. I was thrown into the sea in an instant. Coughing, I came up for air. I hadn't had the time to take a big enough breath, but as I finally got a hold of my surroundings, I felt fingers clasp my ankle as I was pulled under the surface without a moment to react. Down, down, down I was dragged until I was released, the being brushing past my arm. I could feel its harsh scales scrape across my skin, and as I looked to my would-be attacker, all I saw was the inky black abyss that surrounded me. Water truly is terrifying. Your movements are slow, you can't breathe, you can't smell, you can't hear. All of your senses are dulled or taken away when you're submerged. But clear as day in that ocean, I heard the sounds of stone grating against stone, as if a boulder was rolling down a slope. I can't put words to it, but at that moment, I could feel something moving beneath me, under the sea. A voice, unlike any living being's, echoed in my head. Francis Thurston, for years you have shown sympathy to those whose minds would be taken by me. Sarah has led you here, and now you shall be my prophet. Panic enveloped me as my limbs flailed, attempting to ferry me to the surface. More and more water could be felt being displaced and moved beneath me as I swam harder than I ever had. Moonlight streamed down, scattered by the water, as I felt this large entity gaining on me. Breaching the surface, I swam as fast as I could to the nearest landmass. Evidently, a storm had gathered in my time underwater and had begun pouring. Sheets of rain slapped the water's surface as a rocky cliff came into view. Heaving my exhausted body onto the rock pile, I turned to where I was just moments ago. Something enormous was rising up out of the ocean, shrouded by the clouds. Its outline was visible through flashes of lightning. Great wings rose, outstretched from its back. Its arms were gigantic, and the outline of tentacles could be seen around its mouth. Its hand rose out of the water in horrible claws, could be seen on each finger. This was the he that Brown referred to. In my adrenaline-fueled escape, I hadn't noticed that where the thing had grabbed my ankle, there was a deep gash that was leaking crimson blood. Again, I looked up to see this being turning slowly towards me. Each footstep an earthquake, each breath a hurricane. This being was on a scale wholly unique to itself. I was but an ant in this god's path, and it paid no attention to me. No, this thing had risen above God. This thing was a force of nature. This is the great dreamer. This is Cthulhu. Soon, my blood loss had become too great, and after a few minutes, I succumbed and passed out. I awoke, the sun shining on my face, back in my hotel room. The window was closed, my clothes were dry, it was like nothing happened. I got up and walked around, asking if there had been a storm the previous night, but no one remembers even seeing so much as a cloud. Was it all just a dream? Was I losing my mind because of my profession? Did Mr. Brown's suicide disturb me that deeply? I returned home that night to Frank, waiting at my facility with another bottle of bourbon. So what'd you do with Brown's body? What? How do you even know about that, Francis? What do you mean? You're the one who had me examine him. No, he committed suicide after he killed his family. Francis, you can't examine a dead man. You know that, right? I sat there in stunned silence. I really was losing my mind. I had made it all up. Was Sarah real? Was I even a psychiatrist? Hey, Francis, what's that scar? That one there, on your ankle, looks pretty bad. Did one of your patients give that to you? I hope you enjoyed Thalassophobia by one very talented anonymous author, as performed by yours truly. I'd like to personally thank you for joining me tonight for this episode of Scary Stories Told in the Dark. If you enjoyed what you've heard, please take a moment to stop by our iTunes page or wherever else you listen to your favorite podcast and leave us a 5-star review and a kind word. Makes a huge difference and would mean a lot to us. If you'd like to hear a premium extended edition of tonight's and all of our other episodes, featuring Twice the Terror, visit simplyscarypodcast.com today and click the patrons link in the menu at the top of the screen. You'll find yourself at chillingtalesfordarknights.com, where you can purchase season passes for this podcast and our other quality storytelling programs, or become a patron for as little as $5 per month and get access to our entire audio archive dating back to 2012, all of it ad-free. If you happen to use Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or YouTube, you can follow and subscribe to Chilling Tales for Dark Nights there, where you'll get all of our latest updates and new releases and have the chance to interact with us each and every week. You can subscribe to me on YouTube as well at the Otis Gyrie channel, where you'll find releases of my series Horror Storytime, dating back to 2014. And you can find me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, too. Just search for Otis Gyrie. Until next week, stay spooky and get some sleep, if you can. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to Scary Stories Told in the Dark, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcasts network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com today
to learn more about our network and our other amazing storytelling programs. Tonight's program was hosted, and its featured stories, performed by yours truly, Otis Gyre. Selected stories have been adapted with the kind permission of their respective authors. Original music provided by Luke Hodgkinson and Jesse Cornett. Sound design and final mixing and mastering provided by executive producer and director Craig Groschek. Program's artwork and logo by David Romero. If you're looking for some fresh tales on a daily basis while waiting for the next podcast, check out my YouTube channel, the Otis Gyre channel, and my extensive collection of narrated tales there. Simply search on YouTube by my name, and you'll find me. And don't forget to subscribe and press the bell notification icon to get my latest releases. Got a scary tale of your own that you'd like performed? I take submissions. Email it to me today at otis@simplyscarypodcast.com to have your terrifying tome considered for production in a future episode of this show. That's otis@simplyscarypodcast.com. If you've enjoyed what you heard on tonight's program and are joining us on your favorite podcast app, subscribe to us to be sure you never miss an episode and leave a 5-star review and a comment. Your feedback means a lot to me. You can also follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights and yours truly on Facebook to connect anytime and get the latest updates on this and other programs and my channel. If you're listening on the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights YouTube channel, do us a favor and hit the subscribe button and the bell notification icon for CTFDN as well to get more spooky tales from me and the crew and another episode of this program each and every Wednesday. And don't forget to hit that thumbs up button to tell us how we're doing and leave a kind word or a request. And don't forget to visit us at ChillingTalesForDarkNights.com and consider supporting the team by becoming a patron. In addition to helping us out, you'll get exclusive access to our audio archive and ad-free downloads of all your favorite stories, including those you've heard on this program. As for me, I'll be back next Wednesday with more terrifying tales to keep you up all night. But that's all right. Who needs sleep anyway?
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.